Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey guys, want to say thank you for joining us for Fightful Movie Club. I am Rob Wilkins.
And I am Gisberto Guzzo. And today is our first episode. We are going to be talking with Mason Madden about Kill Bill Volume 1. We just wanted to take this time to thank him for joining us and talking about one of his favorite movies.
Yeah. And this is, again, our first episode, so we hope you enjoy it. And by all means, the more we do it, the better we'll get. That's how usually first podcasts go. So I think you'll really enjoy it. And this is going to be a show where there's not going to be much wrestling talk at all, if any. It just gives pro wrestlers a chance to talk about anything other than pro wrestling for the most part. If they bring it up, cool. For the most part, we won't bring it up because we tell them in advance that, hey, we want to talk to you about movies. And they're usually like, hey, that sounds good. So we hope you enjoy this show, and I think you'll like it. We have some pretty good guests lined up, but we're not going to share that information yet. But we did get a really good guest for this first episode, and just want to say thank you again to Mason Madden for joining us, and we hope you really enjoy this episode. Do us a favor, hit that subscribe button, hit that thumbs up for us. That does a lot of good for us right here on Fightful. So thank you, and we will talk to you soon, and we hope you like this episode. So thank you. Bye-bye.
This was your first episode. That makes it even better.
Yes, sir. And how are you doing, Mason?
I'm doing great. Just getting over a little bit of a cold, but this is one of my favorite movies, so I'm really excited to talk about it.
Yeah, when Gisberto told me we were going to be reviewing this, I was excited because it's like it gives me a reason to watch it again because it's been a long time since I've watched it.
Yeah,
and I was pumped. So
When you guys asked, you were like, okay, well, if you were to talk about a movie for an hour or whatever, what would you talk about? And I narrowed it down to this or Shrek 2. But either way, I'm very happy to go with either one.
So before we get into Kill Bill, any specific reason it sort of just narrowly edged out Shrek?
So I think Shrek 2 is one of the best, not only animated movies of all time, but one of the greatest sequels of all time for a movie. I think it elevated it in every way. I think everything from like the top to bottom, it's like a perfect movie. And it's kind of like the defining film of my childhood. Kill Bill also I watched not as a child, but as like a teenager. But it kind of shaped a lot of the movies that I would go on to watch later down the line. It kind of shaped my taste. So it was which defining film of my life, Shrek 2 or Kill Bill Volume 1.
Nice.
Yeah, I was the same with Kill Bill. Didn't get across to it until I was a teenager, and then finally got it from HMV, and the DVD was on replay all the time. But I'm curious for you, the difference between Kill Bill 1, Kill Bill 2, or do you kind of consider it one film for you, or what's the distinction for you? What makes one better than two?
I consider it one film, probably. I used to have I think there was a version of the DVD that basically had it as one film with the little intermission in between with the did it.
Yeah.
But for me, if I had to, you know, narrow it down to one or the other, while I also like Western movies, and I've kind of learned to like Western movies from Kill Bill Volume 2, I'm a weeaboo, if you can't see by my anime statues in the background. So the more samurai-focused Kill Bill Volume 1 was right up my alley. It's even got a little anime segment in it. So it was all really fire for me.
Rob, are you much of an anime fan?
I've tried, but I'm not. I've tried like many times, and there just hasn't been one that's like gotten me yet. All my friends
find the one that hooks you.
Yes, yeah, and I've had friends like try, like they've given me recommendations, and by I mean, don't get me wrong, I like animated like other ones. Like I mean, I love X-Men 97 that's coming out. I cannot wait for. But I mean, as far as like anime goes, I just haven't gotten into it as much as others have. But
my wife is kind of big into the anime manga, and she actually knows you from that world, Mason. And so she's got a huge bookshelf with all these books. So as she's reading them, she's passing them on to me. So she's handing me over like Tokyo Revengers and Blue Lock and all these different books. So I'm slowly sort of getting integrated into that world.
I'm actually like famously good at finding somebody's entry level anime, right? Because for me specifically, I've consumed a lot, but I'm also a self-aware otaku. Like I understand that, you know, not everybody's into the very anime. The quote unquote animes that are like, you know, like a Dragon Ball Z or a Naruto that really feel like anime. You know, I've always existed in these spaces that either people were kind of very entry level with stuff, especially nerd stuff, whether it be football or, I mean, wrestling hardly anymore. But I was always good at finding like, okay, what kind of movie do you like? What kind of genre of film do you like? And then translating that into this anime is kind of like that kind of thing. So maybe I'll have to do that for you one day.
Yeah, I'd be up for that for sure. So, like before we get started, I know you were talking about how you got into like Westerns. As far as Quentin Tarantino goes, are there other Quentin Tarantino films that you enjoy?
Oh, I love most of them, if not all of them. Kill Bill, I think, was my first one, which kind of sent me down the rabbit hole. Obviously, you know, there's your Django's, your Inglourious Bastards. Of course, Pulp Fiction. Mansoor and I, when we were pitching new gimmicks, one of the ones that we pitched and we were really passionate about was we were watching Reservoir Dogs on the road at right before a Raw. And we were like, why don't we do this? If we can't be models, like we can, because one of our strengths, I felt like as a duo is kind of that Tarantino-esque conversation, you know, the conversations that the characters have in those movies that he's famous for. Our back and forth is kind of like that just in the car. So we were like, yeah, why don't we film a promo that's kind of in the style of like a Reservoir Dogs or like a Pulp Fiction. And so I've always been a really big fan of that stuff.
Before we get into the...
Froze.
You froze up there.
So now, are we all good?
Yep, you're good. Yep,
you're back. Or maybe not.
Yeah, we lost him. So I'll just go ahead and... Like with Tarantino, like the film that got me was Pulp Fiction. I actually snuck in to see that when I was too young. But he was somebody that I just enjoyed his writing a lot. And as I got older, I got into his movies more and more. And I actually have a cousin of mine that was, she was in From Dusk Till Dawn with him. Oh, and bro. So... I just like kept just being involved, and then I found out he wrote True Romance, and I just absolutely just always got into his work, and It's one of those things that I've.
I think there's something kind of cool, because it's like you said, you snuck into Pulp Fiction when you were too young, and I was probably too young. I was probably like 13 when I saw the Kill Bill for the first time. It's like the way Tarantino makes movies, it's almost like this, it's kind of immature in a way. Like it's very like ultra violent, and you know, it's kind of whatever's at the front of his head when he's writing it. So I think it translates really well to like that teenage, preteen, adolescent, you know, almost fake maturity. Like, okay, what's a mature movie? The one where people get cut in half and blown up kind of thing. Which I really admire.
There you go. You're back now.
Sorry about that. We're in a really secluded location and the internet here is horrible.
So I just asked him, like I told him about my Quentin Tarantino, like how I got and just fell in love with his work because I snuck in to see Pulp Fiction. So it's one of those things that I just got into his work. But if you want to throw a question out there now.
Yeah, no, I guess for me with Tarantino, I have Kill Bill really high on my list. It's just right behind Inglourious Basterds and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. But I'm not one of those people that is like super big on like Pulp Fiction, but I have it right up there on that level of Django. But as far as like the Quentin Tarantino kind of piece of it all, is Kill Bill a movie because it's like so referential? Is it a movie that when you watched it, it kind of made you want to go back and kind of learn about all the different movies that influenced it? Or was that something you were already into?
No, like I was saying, I was young. So kind of seeing the Lady Snowblood, for example, it's very referential to Lady Snowblood. This was the movie that made me go and look. I'm like, oh, where did this come from? Let me go see that. Well, where did this come from? Let me go see that kind of thing. So that's honestly, you know, people knock Tarantino for that kind of thing. But also it's such a good like entry level into different films that you just otherwise wouldn't have heard of. Because Tarantino does make big Hollywood blockbusters that are in theaters and are very popular and get big budgets. So, you know, everybody sees them. As opposed to some of the smaller films that he references. And it's not like he's stealing from it. He's stealing from it in the way that, but he lets you know exactly what he's stealing from, which is, I think, good.
And I guess kind of looking back on it now, we're 21 years removed from Kill Bill. Like, I suppose we sort of grew up in that cable generation where you could kind of flip around the channels at night and you could find those sort of old Japanese martial arts TV shows where you see the dubbing and the wire work and all the stuff that Quentin Tarantino loves. Do you think that plays as well today for a newer audience, or do you think they would find that really cool and like get them interested in that sort of thing? Like, I don't know if you've ever kind of talked to anyone about that sort of.
It's actually a really good question. I think the you know, the medium of TV, you know, people don't watch cable as much. You used to be able to flip through the channels late at night and then like Kill Bill, a very censored version of Kill Bill would be on. Actually, one of my favorite things is watching the censored version when Beatrix is in the hospital and Buck comes in and she's got him like dead to rights in the door. And in the censored version, he says, she has the flashback and she's like, your name is Buck and you like to party. And he's like, you know, right before she kills him. But I think people have more, and I feel this way about anime too, people have much more access to everything. Like if somebody's interested in something like a Kill Bill, it's very easy to find what streaming service that's on and go find it, as opposed to having to go out and buy a DVD or waiting for the right moment for it to be on TV. So I think if people are interested in a certain type of movie or show or anything, it's very easy for them to find it now. So it's a lot more like niche communities as opposed to these big tent poles where everybody's experienced it.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, should we get into the synopsis now, Gilberto?
Yeah, well, I mean, the synopsis of the movie is it's about as straightforward as you're going to find. A bride wakes up after 4 years in a coma, and she goes out looking for revenge on the people who put her in that coma. it's a straightforward, and the kind of cool thing about Kill Bill is that the story isn't necessarily deep. You don't really need to know all that much about it. You just have to know that these people hurt this woman on her wedding day. They killed her unborn child in the process, and she's out for revenge, and that's cool. You shouldn't need to know anything more. The movie isn't so much about the story for me. It's about kind of the fun that you can tell they had making the movie.
Absolutely.
Like all these different chapters and sequences. It's so kind of referential, but it's so original at the same time, because you have a samurai film, you have a Yakuza film, you have an anime sequence, you have a spaghetti Western, you have that hospital scene, which is like kind of like his homage to Brian De Palma. And then you have RZA's soundtrack, which takes like original music.
So good. So good.
And Ennio Morricone. And like, you have all these different things that shouldn't work when you put them together. But I've watched this movie 3 times in the last week getting ready for this podcast, and it's so much fun.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's the thing where I think me as a creative type of person, I always, my creative process is very much like that, where I just want to enjoy what I'm doing when I'm being creative. So I want to pull from stuff that I like. And that's exactly what they do in these movies, is it's just like, oh, let's do something like this. Let's do, you know, let's see if we can recreate this moment from this movie or something like that. And it's such this like mishmash hodgepodge of just the stuff the creator likes. And that's kind of what's defined the kind of content that I like, is I like stuff that the creator really liked making. And it's very evident when the creator does like making the stuff that they're making.
Yeah. Rob, I don't know how you felt about how everything sort of comes together, because you have this meshing of so many different genres and styles. And does it work for you, or does it feel sort of kind of disjointed at any points?
No, it completely works for me. I absolutely love the movie. And I loved it. I saw it in the theater when it came out. And I think the most disappointing thing for me was Vivica A. Fox was not in the movie that long. I grew up with a big crush for her. So, which, you know, the thing is that scene, you know,
what
that,
a great 5 minutes she was in, though.
Yeah. Oh,
incredible.
There was drama, because Uma Thurman's character, it was like in that short time, she kind of, I would say, connected, like she knew, like they had you could tell they had a friendship.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it's the thing where, like you said, it's not necessarily about the story. The story is very simple and straightforward, but you can tell that they have, all these characters have this rich history with each other. Because if I remember correctly, Volume 1 starts off with that scene with Vivica A. Fox, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
they jump right into the action, right? And in that like very short period of time, you were able to tell these two knew each other. They haven't seen each other in a long time. Without saying anything, you know, Vivica A. Fox has moved on from this assassin lifestyle. You can tell that the bride is upset that she's getting to live the life that she had taken from her, right? And and then while that's all going on, the freaking bus pulls up, and then they stop because they're both still moms, right? And they still understand. They're like, let's not do this in front of the kid. And then they have that really human moment where they catch up, right? After fighting, they're like, so how you been? What have you been up to? And kind of thing. That's so good. So freaking good.
Yeah. And even though, I mean, guys, the movie's over 20 years old, so sorry, spoiler alert.
Catch up.
Yeah. The it was funny. I went to the grocery store yesterday and I bought my cereal, and I couldn't help but like think about that scene, like after I grabbed my box of cereal, with Vivica A. Fox, how she tried to take Uma Thurman's character out. It was just one of those things. And then I remember, I've seen this movie countless times, and I remember thinking, oh man, like just from a fan standpoint, that little girl's old enough now. And it's not going to happen because Tarantino's already talked about he's wrapping up with his career. But I'm like, that girl's old enough now. She could go after.
There's still time for volume three. Yeah.
I'm like, that's the fan in me. Like, it was just oh, she's old enough. And I was just, man. But
I love when the little girl comes in the room and she still has the audacity to say, your mother had it coming.
Yeah. it's so perfect because the movie is just about like hurt people hurting people and like cycles of revenge and somebody trying to kill somebody and failing and then that coming back around and biting them. And it, like you said, it would have been so perfect for just the new story to be that little girl who was hurt in the very start of this this new like revenge cycle to be the one that completes the next revenge cycle. And then that sparks some other thing in the future kind of thing, where it's just like, yeah, this is what's going to happen forever because nobody's going to forgive each other. Everybody's a freaking awesome trained assassin.
Yeah. A couple just like random notes that I had written down from that, the Vivica A. Fox sequence, which I love so much, which I wish it would have lasted longer, was one, I die laughing every time they call each other bitch. They throw it back and forth so much and so loosely. It's like this is some sort of like kind of relationship that they have, and it's fantastic.
And it's so like blaxploitation. Like Vivica Fox is clearly like the, you know, the Foxy Brown stand-in. In that Deadly Viper Assassination Squad. So the dialogue is very like, you know, jive turkey, bitch.
Yeah. And they even, her kind of, her new name in her quiet suburban life now is Jeannie Bell, which was the name of a blaxploitation film star. So it's homage to that. And then the fight scene was an homage to Coffee. And yeah, as I'm sure as we keep going through this, we're just going to just like, this was a reference to this. This was a reference to that. And just I wish I had that amount of like film knowledge that Tarantino's just pulling from all these movies and just being like, oh, I could do this or, oh, I could do that. Yeah. And also
it's like the language he's speaking. It's the language. Yeah. He's just speaking in the language of films. It's like, yeah, this is just how I talk.
Yeah. And my last thing was when she shoots at Beatrix, the cereal box says kaboom, which I think is just a great touch that always makes me laugh.
Yep. Yeah, it's silly. That's what I love about it. It doesn't take itself too seriously, which I think is great in art, is, you know, enjoy yourself. Don't take yourself too seriously. That's when you really, like, the audience can feel that when you're having fun.
Yeah. And like you said, like with you and Mansoor, you can be serious, you can be silly, like you can do all these things at the same time and it can work. Like, right. I think a lot of times people like to say, oh, you have to do this, you have to do that. But I don't see why people can't kind of just, if you're smart about it and put the time and the thought into it, you can put different genres together and it can work.
Yeah, that's what one of my mantras in wrestling has always been, as much as I love it and I've always wanted to do it for my entire life, is to never forget that I get paid to play fight in my underwear. And when you put that into perspective, then it makes it a lot harder for you to take yourself too seriously to the point where you know, you're coming off a little prickly. I never forget that. And I got that from my great uncle, my dad's uncle. When he found out that I was wrestling in WWE, he was like, you get paid all that money to play fight in your underwear? And I was like, damn, uncle, you're right. that is ridiculous. What a ridiculous concept. And that should be the point. It's absurd. Like, it should be fun.
No, absolutely. Rob, do you have any other scenes you want to touch on next?
No, I pretty much agreed with you on that. I thought the casting for going back to Vivica A. Fox, I thought that was great. I mean, going back to that scene, I really enjoy that. And I think overall, that whole thing, that whole scene in the kitchen, going back and forth, it was just classic in my opinion, because
such a tone after center.
Yeah, and after the scene, like the when the scene ends, you like what I thought about was, man, I want to know the story afterward too. Like, you know, part of me is like, when her husband gets home, or the cleanup, and like what happened, and the talk to the daughter, because it that's the one thing I like about Tarantino, is he lets you continue the story in your head,
right?
And that's what I think is brilliant about him. So that's all I wanted to add, is he let the story continue. He let that part of the story continue in your own adaptation, the way you wanted it to.
Mm-hmm. So I guess before we can go kind of like through this chapter by chapter, I guess that'd be an easy way to break it up. But we already talked about Tarantino. I guess the other kind of key piece to talk about here would be Uma Thurman and how great she is in this movie. And I always kind of, I don't know what happened after this movie, but this was kind of, it feels like the last great thing I ever saw her in. And she does like everything here. She's charming in those scenes with Hattori Hanzo. She's great at the action. She's, you feel like the kind of like pain and sadness when she wakes up. And I don't know. I wish we could have seen more from her after this, because I don't know about you, but like, I think she's great in this movie. And I don't know if we want to like relitigate the Oscars from 2004, but I feel like maybe she should have got a nomination for everything she had to do here.
It's like you said, it's crazy that, I can't think of much else from her afterwards. I remember seeing her and like pop up in a few other things after I had seen Kill Bill. But yeah, I just thought she was so great. I think what's kind of another fun thing about Tarantino is obviously that he uses a lot of the same cast. So it really does have that vibe of, you know, obviously he worked with Uma in Pulp Fiction. It has that vibe of, I'm making movies with my friends. You know, I'm making movies with people that I like and understand, and I know how to get the most out of them. So I don't know, maybe if Tarantino's wrapping up his career and he's only got a couple more movies left, I'd love to see her in another one.
Yeah, because I mean, if we look back at the Oscars, you had, I mean, Charlize Theron for Monster, great. Diane Keaton, Something's Gotta Give, sure. Samantha Morton in America, Naomi Watts, 21 Grams, Keisha Castle Hughes, Whale Rider. I don't know. I feel like if we're looking back 20 years from now, I feel like Uma Thurman's performance in this movie is kind of as memorable and iconic as any of those, maybe.
Definitely on par, yeah.
Yeah. So I guess next after the Vivica A. Fox sequence, and also just going back to the opening credits, I love how they introduce like the Deadly Viper Assassination Squad, and you have like all the code names like Copperhead, Snake Charmer, Cottonmouth.
Vivica A. Fox is like, I should have been Black Mamba.
Yeah.
Why are you Black Mamba?
And it's so, like, right away, you're just like, who are these people and kind of what's their deal? And it's like a fun nod to like Marvel with their, like, the Serpent Society. I think all those names kind of get pulled from there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, but then we go to the hospital and we meet Daryl Hannah's Ellie, and she's coming to finish the job on the bride. I guess the one question I had from that sequence was, why does Bill call her and stop her? Like, he was obviously the one who sent her, unless she was going of like her own volition, right? He calls her and says,
yeah, he sent her.
Yeah. So he calls, he's like, oh, that's not enough. So like, he just changed his mind at the last minute. Is this just like,
it's because he loves her. It's, yeah, a love story. It's a yeah, big romantic story. He wanted to see her again. When he found out that he was, you know, obviously he pulled the trigger, right? He was the last one to shoot her. But when he found out that, you know, she didn't die by his hand, he was like, well, I want her to die by my hand. I want to see her again and do it myself. And when you watch volume two, at the end of that, spoilers for a 30-year-old movie, but he just wants to have a conversation. He freaking shoots her with the truth serum. And he's like, I want to know how you actually felt about me. And if you thought you were going to get away from me like that before doing the honorable thing and like, okay, let's sword fight on the beach. So I think that's exactly it. Is he just didn't want to, he wanted to be the one to do it.
Oh, that's fair. And then, and then we meet Buck. Well, first we get like the stuff with Ellie coming in whistling Twisted Nerve, which was like, she's great in that movie. I love how no one in the hospital clocked like the nurse whistling with the eye patch. It's like, all right, we're just going to let her pass. But I mean, this is the same place that lets Buck come to work in a car that says, you know, what it says.
The pussy wagon.
The pussy wagon, which was another, because I know Tarantino, one of his favorite, like he talks about it all the time. He loves the Brian De Palma movie Blowout with John Travolta. And so he's been a big Travolta fan. That's why he kind of revived Travolta's career with Pulp Fiction. So Pussy Wagon was a kind of an homage to the lyric from Grease Lightning.
I didn't know that. I actually didn't know that.
Yeah. And then, then we meet Buck, and Buck needed to die a much more violent, painful death than he had.
He deserved so much worse.
He got lucky.
It's the thing where in these Tarantino movies, it's obviously in a reality that is so much like worse than our own. Like everything, everybody is so much worse. Everybody is so much more vile. And like, it's like you said, the really sus nurse with the eye patch whistling happily with a weird needle. Nobody bats an eye because that's just normal in the hospital where the creepy nurse is also, you know, selling the bodies of the comatose patients. Like, it's just run-of-the-mill Tarantino world type of business as usual.
You know, one of the things that I like to talk about as kind of like a random fact about this movie is the sheriff that you see is played by, or he's actually a Texas Ranger. He's played by Michael Parks. His role is Earl McGraw, and he's the one that was investigating the massacre at the Wedding Chapel. Now, his character is a recurring character in other Tarantino films. He played the same role in From Dusk Till Dawn, and he's in both segments in Grindhouse. So I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's a reoccurring. Well, it kind of lends itself to the fact that these all happen in the same world, essentially.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, that that's why he's not surprised by this horrible wedding massacre.
Yeah.
Is he's like, oh yeah, this is bad stuff happens all the time.
Now, a very important question. You know, we've seen it in Kill Bill. We've seen it in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and I'm sure it shows up in other Tarantino movies that I'm forgetting about right now. How many feet photo websites do you think Quentin Tarantino is on? That man has got a thing with like bare feet, just close ups on them.
And he doesn't even hide it. Honestly, you got to respect.
No.
You got to respect his dedication to the craft. To be so openly a foot guy.
Yeah, he's leading the charge, isn't he?
Yeah, no, he's a revolutionary. You get those zoomed in. He made the whole scene in the back of the pickup truck. Yeah. Just zoomed in on the toes.
Yeah, let's make these piggies wiggle.
Yeah. Uma Thurman specifically, because they do the same thing in Pulp Fiction. She's barefoot dancing.
Yeah.
And they zoom in on those.
And that's probably why he just said, you know what? I got to make another movie. I just miss those toes. So let's just, I got to write this up.
Never forget.
Yeah.
So while she's sitting in the back of the truck trying to get her legs and feet to start working again, then we transition into the origin story of Oren Ishii, which is played by Lucy Liu, who Tarantino claims to have decided to cast her after watching Shanghai Noon. I don't know if I believe, but sure. then we go into the anime sequence, which from the internet research I did, done by the same production company that did Ghost in the Shell and a bunch of other kind of famous animes. The opening sequence in there, Death Rides a Horse, Miller's Crossing, lots of kind of film references. But as the anime fan in the room here, what did you think of Tarantino's take on anime?
It was great. It's the same, you know, referential to the other things in the medium that he likes and that he wants to take from. First off, never forget from the Kill Bill official soundtrack by the RZA. He's got a song about Oren Ishii, and it's my favorite line in the song is Oren Ishii, half Chinese, half American, half Japanese. Never forget. RZA, I don't know. That's three halves. I don't know if that adds up. I don't know. In American isn't, you know, really an ethnicity. So you can, but no, I love that sequence. And it's, it kind of is the, because obviously you jump into the Vivica A. Fox scene. You know that Vivica A. Fox wronged her in the beginning, right? But this is the first time you see somebody, one of the other Viper's backstories. And it's equally as tragic. So you have to imagine that Bill just collects these very tragic, femme fatales. And that's kind of like they've all got a horrible backstory that they overcame to be in this assassination squad. And they're all 4 years out. So they've all moved on. And this ghost from the past is hunting them all back down. And for them to do it in that anime sequence, which, I'll always sing the praises of, I don't hate live action remakes of things, but they just aren't able to capture things the same way as the animation. And it's a discredit to the art form of animation because it's able to do so many things that live action just can't. So, especially because, you know, in the West, we very much consider animation to be a kid's thing. And to be able to tell an adult story in the medium of animation with all of the tricks that animation allows you to do, I think is really cool.
Of the live action ones, is there any that you think have kind of done okay? Or is there any that maybe you think were like the most egregiously bad? Because I know Netflix right now, they just released their new Avatar series, which has been getting kind of mixed reactions.
Can't be worse than the movie, right?
Yeah, you're right on that.
I think they're getting better. Netflix specifically, I think the live action One Piece was pretty good for what it was meant to be. I still don't think that any of these things replace the original, obviously. And I think now they're starting to realize that they can't replace the original. So they're trying to take it in different directions, which makes it better. The notably egregious one would be Dragon Ball Evolution, where it didn't look like anybody even watched Dragon Ball before they watched that or before they made that. Ghost in the Shell wasn't great, but at least it seemed like people watched it. So it's almost like this gradual scale of like, did anybody on staff actually watch the original, right? And I think we're getting more to the point where Oda, who wrote One Piece, was very hands-on with the creation of the live action. So I guess it's giving all those people their flowers now, which is good. And they're getting paid, so even better.
Yeah. Well, how did you feel about Alita, just out of curiosity?
Alita, I thought, was very good. I thought Alita was very good. I think Speed Racer is one of the best anime adaptations by the Wachowskis of all people. And I think that's because they try and make it, you don't try and make a cartoon realistic. Alita, very, you know, they took the, they made the decision to give her big, weird bug eyes. Don't try and not make it anime. Let it be anime. That's why I think Kill Bill is so good, is because it's not trying to be anything that is not.
No, absolutely. Rob, anything?
Just to throw another fact out there that I like about this movie, or that I find interesting about this movie, is that Tarantino actually had somebody else in mind to play David Carradine's part. He was originally writing the role for Warren Beatty. But I think in the long run, David Carradine was perfect for this.
Yeah.
Well, I think he had some TV experience in a samurai show, didn't he?
He was a TV karate man. He was like a Chuck Norris type. Yeah.
Kung Fu, right? Was it?
Yeah, Kung Fu. Show?
Yeah. Yeah. So.
Go ahead.
No.
I was just gonna move it on to the next chapter, which is The Man from Okinawa, which I think is the best chapter of Kill Bill 1 or Kill Bill 2. Sonny Chiba just absolutely steals the show as Hattori Hanzo reprising his role from Shadow Warriors or Kage no Gundan from the 80s. So he's like, I guess Tarantino kind of considers him like the 100th version of that character, but in his universe now.
Hattori Hanzo is a real
swordsmith in history.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which was something I learned because I was like, wait, how's he still alive? But my favorite line of like most movies is in that segment when he finally does make the sword. After finding out that she had big rodents to kill, when the whole ceremony where he's sitting there and she's presenting her the sword, and he says, "I can say without any arrogance that if you come across God on your journey, God will be cut." I was like, "That is so fire! That is so good! That's like etched in my heart. That's such a good line."
Yeah. Oh yeah. He's got so many great lines. My favorite one is, yeah, that one's incredible, but I love funny. You like samurai swords? I like baseball.
Baseball.
And then he throws the ball at her. She cuts it in half. That's so great.
And even just the presentation of him, he's this legendary swordsman. And it kind of goes to like the themes of everybody's moved on from their, you know, their past. He's just, he works at a sushi restaurant. And he's just like an overbearing boss to the kid that works the front counter.
Yeah, Johnny Moe, who actually plays in Kill Bill 2, he plays the one who trains Beatrix. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's Johnny Moe. He's like, oh, by now I would have been a general. He's like, well, if you're with the general, I'd be the emperor and you'd still be fetching the sake. It's just so outstanding. Yeah, I don't know, Rob, how do you feel about that?
I loved the
sequence in the restaurant.
I thought that was great. Like the whole, just his reaction when he went downstairs, like just, he's like, give me a month. Like, or he said it'll take me 1 month. I loved everything about it. That whole scene was just perfect because I remember the first time seeing it, I couldn't really get a read on him. Like I didn't understand like if he was, it had a dramatic feel again because I couldn't tell if he was like scared of her or if he was nervous or if he was like disappointed. I could not tell by his reaction. And when I watched it again this last week, it reminded me of that. I couldn't tell based off the way he was acting. And I realized that's just the way he is. And that's his character. And I thought that was well made. I enjoyed that.
I think what's so great about these movies is they show, you know, it's the old show don't tell thing where they don't explain all the history that these characters have together. Right. But in that conversation, the thing that's able to make him go from funny uncle to serious baddest swordsmith that's ever existed was seeing Bill's name written on the window.
The window.
And all of a sudden you're like, okay, Bill's a bad dude. Bill's wronged so many people all over the world that this guy in Japan is ready to ride or die and break an oath that he swore that he'd never make a sword again to make sure that this guy was dead. Yeah. So it's like, it really, it, to use a wrestling term, it puts over your heel.
Yeah.
No, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I wish there was like an extended just cut of that whole sequence, especially the beginning of it when he's just kind of like being like really kind of like flirty and charming with her and just being,
yeah.
Oh, it's like, you speak Japanese like a Japanese person. And when she orders the sake, he's like, oh, warm sake, arigato, very good. Like,
we say arigato.
Oh, yeah. It's just, it's so outstanding. It's, this movie's low key really, really funny. It doesn't it get is. Enough credit for how funny it is.
I think most Tarantino movies are really just kind of these dark comedies where it's obviously violence is a big part of them, but it's also humor. I think it's like I said before, it's the absurdity of all of it, which makes a delicious stew.
And Tarantino wanted to kind of use this as like a platform to him to show he was like he could be an action director because he kind of reveres them so much. But it's funny that for me, this scene that kind of resonates the most is the one when it's the two people conversing, which is, of course, what he's known for. Yeah. So after that, we finally kind of get the bride hops on the airplane with her sword, walking through an airport with her sword. No problems there. She makes it to Japan, and then we finally get the showdown between her and O-Ren, but not before she fights off all the members of the Crazy 88s.
Crazy 88s.
And
I liked,
like, oh, sorry, 200 versus one battle.
What I liked about like how they introduced her was when they were having the, when she was having the meeting with the Yakuza, and she basically, she got on the table and ran and used that sword and
cuts that guy's slice, head off.
Yeah. Yeah. Slice his head and just bust blood, and you just see the squirt, like the blood just going in the air. Just absolutely just, I forgot about that scene. So when it happened, I was like, oh yeah. Yep. There it is. Yep, forgot. Made it even better. So
Miss, what was your reaction to seeing those like blood effects for the first time? Like just the way the blood gushes.
Yeah. That's, I mean, I imagine that was a practical effect on like a dummy with, you know, an actual squirt thing.
Yeah.
I've always been of the opinion that like the film hyperviolence is better than real violence. You know what I mean? There's something very mundane about actual violence. Even in wrestling, when you shoot punch somebody in the face, it usually doesn't look as good as a people, the Rock's punch, right? Ooh. So, it's theatrical. It's funny.
Yeah,
but it still sets the tone for who O-Ren is and what she, you know, takes seriously and what she holds dear and the command that she has as the only woman who's ever led the Yakuza syndicate, as a half Chinese, half American, half Japanese. It's great. I love it.
And yeah, back to your previous point. Yeah, it was practical effects. Tarantino wanted to use practical effects for as much of this movie as he could. And I don't know if this is true, but the internet tells me that they used 450 gallons of fake blood and condoms to create that effect. So
I buy it.
Not sure how that works, but the internet doesn't lie, so we're going to go with it.
I don't know why a regular balloon wouldn't work, but okay.
Yeah, not too sure. Also, great line when she's kind of meeting with the 88s before the fight, when the guy comes in to take their order and they make fun of him for looking like Charlie Brown. I love that too.
Which is actually, I'm just thinking about this now, in a movie that is so referential, where anybody could call out, like, they could call out the bride for walking in dressed like Bruce Lee. Like,
yeah.
But Charlie Brown was what the straw that breaks the camel's back, and everybody has a good laugh at it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, there's the Bruce or Charlie Brown. Yeah, there's so many. Yeah. Like her outfit, the homage to Bruce Lee and his final movie. And then Tarantino loves Bruce Lee. They got the guys all wearing like the Kato masks from Green mm-hmm. Hornet. And I think they even used the Green Hornet's theme when they have the motorcycles driving down the street. And then,
right before another super iconic song. Is it the band that's playing at the restaurant?
Yeah. The 5 6 7 8s.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Great, great song. It's crazy to think of how, for such a gory niche movie, right? There's so many iconic things that are from this movie. The whistle song, it's, you know, obviously the jumpsuit is taken from Bruce Lee, but I think people associate it with Kill Bill now.
Yeah. Yeah.
The 5 6 7 8 song, I think that was in commercials for a time.
It was.
Yeah, so much.
Yeah, and then the Bruce Lee, his fascination with that comes back in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood too, where he kind of has Brad Pitt's character kind of daydreaming, misremembering the time he beat up Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
But then we have like the big fight where she kind of takes on 200 people, and halfway through it goes to black and white. And I was watching the DVD special features, and Tarantino said that they did that because when he was a kid, Japanese films that were too gory on American television, they would present them in black and white so that they didn't get an X rating because of all the blood.
The blood, yeah.
So he did that. And then you have
the shot with when the doors close and you can see the shadows, the silhouettes, and
yeah, with the blue background.
Yes, so good.
Yeah, I think that's from what Samurai Fiction, he said, but yep. It looks so cool, like, and the way everything's choreographed, and then he ends it with a joke with her spanking the kid with the sword.
That's what you get for messing around with Yakuza's go old. Yeah.
Yeah. And then she finally fights Lucy Liu, and
no, don't skip. Don't skip one of my favorites.
Silly Rabbit?
Gogo Yubari.
Oh, right. Yes.
Lucy Liu's Oren's number one bodyguard, who is just a high school girl.
Yeah.
Tarantino got from watching Battle Royale, which is another one of my favorite movies that I learned from. I found out about her, and then I went and watched Battle Royale, which is also pivotal for me. But yeah, Gogo with the ball and chain, very cool fight. After all the blood, guts, and spectacle of killing all the crazy 88s, to go to like a one-on-one situation where she does get hurt. She gets the spike in her foot, and yeah, it's all that climb to it's the game of death type thing where you have to climb the tower to get to the final boss.
I loved like how with the ball and chain, when she missed and it came back and it hit her right in the back of the head. Like she was not,
yeah.
I mean, obviously she was not expecting it. And I just thought that was great. Just the way it just took her down. And that whole fight was just awesome.
Yep. And then the last shot of, cause she takes the plank with the nails in the head. Right. Mm-hmm. And then she's crying the blood tears, and then stops, and then she gets that little break before she has to go into the Lady Snowblood scene.
Yeah. Yeah. And also the quote when her and Lucy Liu come face to face, and she, in unison, silly rabbit, tricks her for kids.
Tricks her for kids. I was like, what does that mean?
Well,
I later found out that's supposed to like hint at her name, right? Because we don't know her name at that point, right? Yeah,
yeah. Because even earlier in the movie, they keep saying like, "Oh, hey there, kiddo," and you just think they're like, "Oh, they're just calling her like a kid."
Yeah.
But yeah, that the final fight with Lucy Liu out in the snow. What thoughts on it? Does it kind of live up to?
Absolutely. It's the roller coaster ride, right? Of obviously, there's action and combat throughout this movie, and you go from the crazy 88s fight, which is all the way up here, and then you end up with the go-go fight, which is still up here. And then it takes a dip because it becomes silent for a second. There's the little water fountain clicking in the background that really framed the shot. Please Don't Let Me Be Misunderstood starts playing, which is an awesome song. When they do the first, you know, clashing of the swords, and even the moment where, all right, Oren thinks that she's got this in the bag, like immediately. She's like, she's tired. I'm better than her anyway. I'm going to kill her. And then they have this one little back and forth, and Oren's like, when she does that little hobble after she got cut in the leg, and she's like, oh, crap. Okay, I apologize, because she was talking trash about, he was like, oh, silly Caucasian girl wants to play with samurai swords. And then she's like, for what I said earlier, I apologize. We're going to fight like real samurai right now. That's so good. I freaking love this movie. I'm hyped watching and talking about it.
And I love that it's after the bride gets cut, Oren cuts her back, then the music stops, and like you said, all you hear is like the water feature. And then Oren tells her, you know, give up now, in this condition you wouldn't last more than 5 minutes. And then it's funny, I didn't know Tarantino said they timed it out so that the fight lasted exactly 4 minutes and 59 seconds.
Yes.
And then you get the great, like the scalping with the sword, and then the Lucy Liu with the
you see her wig fly off.
Yeah. and then the great that really was a Hattori Hanzo sword.
Yep.
Just
good.
And then you get the reveal of the child still being alive.
Yep. Which is a great hook for the next movie. I didn't see it in theaters, but I couldn't imagine if I saw that in theaters and I had to wait. I think the movies came out pretty quickly after
6 months
in theaters, right? Yeah. But still, that's well before, you know, Marvel movies and us being completely used to getting these multi-part installments for a story to be told. So I'm pretty sure I saw them pretty quickly in succession because they were on DVD. But yeah, what a stinger. And the cool shot of her saying the threat to Oren's assistant in the trunk.
Right.
Where she's saying, okay, well, tell them that these people are dead. And they're all about to be as dead as Oren Ishii. I was like, let's go.
It really makes you want to watch 2 like immediately afterwards.
Yeah.
So and hopefully people do.
Yeah. Yes.
So as we wrap up, just is there anything that you've watched recently, like Kill Bill, that you've liked, like within the past maybe month or two, or even the past year, that you would recommend for somebody to watch?
I haven't got to see it, but I'm going to recommend it anyway. I really wanted to go see it. Was Godzilla, the new Godzilla movie?
Okay.
Because my journey to this my otaku weeaboo status started with Godzilla. When I was a kid and my dad played for the Seahawks, we lived in Seattle. And Seattle, big Japanese population. And and so we had certain TV channels that would show Japanese stuff. And I immediately fell in love with Godzilla. They had some Super Sentai shows on. And that's where I also fell in love with Bruce Lee movies, because they had those on all the time too. So By the time Kill Bill came around, this was like the perfect culmination of, you know, tokusatsu and samurai movies and all the stuff that I love. But the last Godzilla movie from Japan. Shin Godzilla is one of my favorite movies ever. And I really wanted to see Godzilla Minus One, but I haven't. I wanted to see it in theaters, but I was, unfortunately, I work again. It came out in the time that it came out after I was sitting at home for 90 days, and now I have to work for a living. But I still recommend everybody sees that because I just want to see more of it all the time.
All right. Well, Gisberto, do you have any other questions you want to throw out before we wrap up?
No, that was incredible. Thank you so much for joining us. And yeah, it was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks for having me on your Volume 1 episode.
Yeah, thank you. You want to tell everybody where they can follow you, or if you have anything you want to, like any shows coming up that you want to bring up?
Yeah, you can find me on all social media at Great Black Otaku. Specifically, you can find me on Twitch at twitch.tv/GreatBlackOtaku, where me and my partner Mansoor, we try to stream twice a week. We also do stuff on the road. Check out our YouTube channel, youtube.com/TheInsidersTV, where we have a couple of different shows and all of our VODs from the Twitch streams go up. And make sure you buy our merch at foryourwear.com/MXM, where you can get all our cool stuff that mostly I've drawn myself. So you're supporting artists in doing so. We've got shows all coming up, but you can see our schedule. It's all on Twitter. So check it out.
Very nice.
Yeah, and we'll make sure to link all those in the description of this video as well.
Thank you.
No problem. Gisberto?
Rob, anything thank you.
Anything you want to plug?
Oh, no. I have social media. I don't really use it. Don't look me up. You can find me here on these videos.
All right. Guys, thank you so much for tuning in. We appreciate it. We will see you again very soon. Take it easy.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.